There is a sweet little horror story that is only two sentences long. The last man on Earth sat alone in a room. There was a knock at the door. Hey folks, how you doing? This is Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster here on the Mystery Hour in Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you very much for tuning in. I appreciate it. First story comes off the interweb. It's written and published in 1948 by Frederick Brown, and it's called Knock. There's a sweet little horror story that is only two sentences long. The last man on Earth sat alone in a room. There was a knock at the door. Two sentences and an ellipsis of three dots. The horror, of course, isn't in the two sentences at all. It's in the ellipses. The implication. What knocked at the door? Faced with the unknown, the human mind supplies something vaguely horrible. But it wasn't horrible, really. The last man on Earth, or in the universe for that matter, sat alone in a room. It was a rather, peculiar room. He'd just noticed how peculiar it was, and he'd been studying out the reason for its peculiarity. His conclusions didn't horrify him, but it annoyed him. Walter Phelan, who had been associate professor of anthropology at Nathan University up until the time 2 days ago when Nathan University had ceased to exist, was not a man who horrified easily. Not that Walter Phelan was a heroic figure by any wild stretch of the imagination. He was slight of stature, mild of disposition. He wasn't much to look at, and he knew it. Not that his appearance worried him now. Right now, in fact, there wasn't much feeling in him. Abstractly, he knew that 2 days ago, within the space of an hour, the human race had been destroyed, except for him and, somewhere, a woman, one woman. And that was a fact which didn't concern Walter Phelan in the slightest degree. He'd probably never see her and didn't care too much if he didn't. Women just hadn't been a factor in Walter's life since, Martha had died a year and a half ago. Not that Martha hadn't been a good wife, albeit a bit on the bossy side. Yes, he loved Martha in a deep, quiet way. He was only 40 now, and he'd been only 38 when Martha had died, but, he just hadn't thought about women since then. His life had been his books. The ones he read, and the ones he wrote. Now, there wasn't any point in writing books, but he had the rest of his life to spend reading them. True, company would be nice, but he'd get along without it. Maybe after a while he'd get so he'd enjoy the occasional company of one of the Zan. Although, that was a bit difficult to imagine. Their thinking was so alien to his that there seemed no common ground for discussion. Intelligent, though they were, in a way. An ant is intelligent, in a way, but no man ever established communication with an ant. He thought of the Zan, somehow, as super ants. Although they didn't look like ants, and he had a hunch that the Zan regarded the human race as the human race had regarded ordinary ants. Certainly, what they'd done to Earth had been what men did to anthills, and it had been done much more efficiently. But they'd given him plenty of books. They'd been nice about that as soon as he told them what he wanted. And he had told them that the moment he had learned that he was destined to spend the rest of his life alone in this room, the rest of his life, or as the Zan had quaintly expressed it, forever. Even a brilliant mind, and the Zan obviously had brilliant minds, had its idiosyncrasies. The Zan had learned to speak terrestrial English in a matter of hours, but they persisted in separating syllables. Well, but we digress. There was a knock at the door. "You've got it all now, except the three dots, the ellipsis, and I'm going to fill that in and show you that it wasn't horrible at all." Walter Phelan called out, "Come in," and the door opened. It was, of course, only a Zan. It looked exactly like the other Zan. If there was any way of telling one from the other, Walter hadn't found it. It was about 4 feet tall and looked like nothing on Earth, nothing, that is, that had been on Earth until the Zan came here. Walter said, "Hello, George." When he'd learned that none of them had names, he decided to call them all George, and the Zan didn't seem to mind. This one said, "Hello, Walter." That was ritual, the knock on the door and the greetings. Walter waited. "Point one," said the Zan. "You will please henceforth sit with your chair turned the other way." Walter said, "I thought so, George. The plain wall is transparent from the other side, isn't it?" "It is transparent." "Just what I thought. I'm in a zoo, right?" "That is right." Walter sighed. "I knew it. That plain blank wall without a single piece of furniture against it and made of something different from the other walls. If I persist in sitting with my back to it, what then? Will you kill me?" I ask hopefully. "We take away your books." "Well, you got me there, George. All right, I'll face the other way when I sit and read." "How many other animals besides me are in this zoo of yours?"
216.
Walter shook his head. "Not complete, George. Even a Bush League zoo can beat that. Could beat that, I mean. If there were any Bush League zoos left. Did you just pick at random?"
"Random samples, yes. All species would have to be too many. Male and female of each 108 kinds.
"Oh, what do you feed them? The carnivorous ones, I mean."
"We make food synthetic."
"Well, that's smart," said Walter. "And the flora, you got a collection of that too?"
"Flora was not hurt by vibrations. It is still all growing."
"Nice for the flora," said Walter. "You weren't as hard on it then as you were on the fauna. Well, George, you started out with point one. I deduced that there is point two kicking around somewhere. What is it?"
"Something we do not understand. Two of the other animals sleep and do not wake. They are cold."
"Well, it happens in the best regulated zoos, George," Walter Phelan said. "Probably not a thing wrong with them except, well, that they're dead."
"Dead? That means stopped, but nothing stopped them. Each was alone."
Walter stared at the Zan. "Do you mean, George, you don't know what natural death is?"
"Death is what a being is killed, stopped from living."
Walter Phelan blinked. "How old are you, George?" he asked.
16, you would not know the word. Your planet went around your sun about 7,000 times. I am still young."
Walter whistled softly. "A babe in arms," he said. He thought hard a moment. "Look, George," he said, "you've got something to learn about this planet you're on. There's a guy who doesn't hang around where you come from, an old man with a beard and a scythe and an hourglass. Your vibrations didn't kill him."
"What is he?"
Call him the Grim Reaper, George. Old Man Death. Our people and animals live until somebody, Old Man Death, stops them ticking."
"He stopped the two creatures. Will he stop more?"
Walter opened his mouth to answer and then closed it again.
Something in the Zan's voice indicated that there would be a worried frown on his face, if he had a face recognizable as such. "How about taking me to these animals who won't wake up?" Walter asked. "Is that against the rules?" "Come," said the Zan. That had been the afternoon of the second day. It was the next morning that the Zan came back, several of them. They began to move Walter Phelan's books and furniture. When they'd finished that, they moved him. He found himself in a much larger room 100 yards away. He sat and waited, and this time, too, there was a knock on the door. He knew what was coming and politely stood up. A Zan opened the door and stood aside. A woman entered. Walter bowed slightly. "Walter Phelan," he said. "In case George didn't tell you my name, George tries to be polite, but he doesn't know all of our ways." The woman seemed calm. He was glad to notice that. She said, "My name is Grace Evans, Mr. Phelan. What's all this about? Why did they bring me here?" Walter was studying her as she talked. She was tall, fully as tall as he, and well-proportioned. She looked to be somewhere in her early 30s, about the age Martha had been. She had the same calm confidence about her that he'd always liked about Martha, even though it had contrasted with his own easygoing informality. In fact, he thought she looked quite a bit like Martha. "Oh, I think you know why they brought you here, but let's go back a bit," he said. "Do you know just what has happened otherwise?"
You mean they've killed everyone?"
"Yes. Please sit down. You know how they accomplished it?" She sank into a comfortable chair nearby.
"No," she said. I don't know just how. Well, not that it matters, does it?"
"No, not a lot. But here's the story. What I know of it from getting one of them to talk and from piecing things together. There isn't a great number of them. Here, anyway. I don't know how numerous a race they are, where they came from, and I don't know where that is, but I guess it's outside the solar system. You've seen the spaceship they came in?"
"Yes, it's as big as a mountain."
"Well, almost. Well, it has equipment for emitting some sort of a vibration, they call it that, in our language. But I imagine it's more like a radio wave than a sound vibration that destroys all animal life. It, the ship itself, is insulated against the vibration. I don't know whether its range is big enough to kill off the whole planet at once, or whether they flew in circles around the Earth, sending out the vibration waves. But it killed everybody and everything instantly and, I hope, painlessly. The only reason we and the other 200-odd animals in this zoo weren't killed was because we were inside the ship. We'd been picked up as specimens. You do know this is a zoo, don't you?"
I suspected it."
"Yeah, the front walls are transparent from the outside. The Zan were pretty clever at fixing up the inside of each cubicle to match the natural habitat of the creatures it contains. These cubicles, such as the one we're in, are of plastic, and they've got a machine that makes one in about 10 minutes. If Earth had had a machine and a process like that, there wouldn't have been any housing shortage." "Well, there isn't any housing shortage now, anyway. And I imagine that the human race, specifically you and I, can stop worrying about the A-bomb and the next war. The Zan certainly solved a lot of problems for us." Grace Evans smiled faintly. "Another case where the operation was successful, but the patient died. Things were in an awful mess. Do you remember being captured? I don't. I went to sleep one night and woke up in a cage on a spaceship."
"No, I don't remember either," Walter said.
"My hunch is that they used the vibration waves at low intensity first, just enough to knock us all out. Then they cruised around picking up samples, more or less at random, for their zoo. After they had as many as they wanted, or as many as they had space in the ship to hold,
I turned on the juice all the way. And that was that. It wasn't until yesterday they knew they'd made a mistake and had underestimated us. They thought we were immortal, as they are. That we were... What? They can be killed, but they don't know what natural death is. They didn't, anyway, until yesterday. Two of us died yesterday. Two of... Oh. Yeah, two of us animals in their zoo. One was a snake, and one was a duck. Two species gone irrevocably. And, by the Zan's way of figuring time, the remaining member of each species is going to live only a few minutes, anyway. They figured they had permanent specimens. You mean they didn't realize what short-lived creatures we are? That's right, Walter said. One of them is young at 7,000 years, he told me. They're bisexual themselves, incidentally, but they probably breed once every 10,000 years or so. When they learned yesterday how ridiculously short a life expectancy we terrestrial animals have, they were probably shocked to the core, if they have cores. At any rate, they decided to reorganize their zoo, two by two instead of one by one. They figure we'll last longer collectively, if not individually. Oh, Grace Evans stood up, and there was a taint flush on her face. If they think... She turned towards the door. It'll be locked, Walter Phelan said calmly. Don't worry. Maybe they think, but I don't think. You needn't even tell me you wouldn't have me if I was the last man on Earth. It would be corny under the circumstances. But they are going to keep us locked together in this little room? It isn't so little. We'll get by. I can sleep quite comfortably in one of these overstuffed chairs, and don't think I don't agree with you perfectly, my dear. All personal considerations aside, the least favor we can do the human race is to let it end with us and not be perpetuated for an exhibition in a zoo. She said, oh, thank you, almost inaudibly, and the flush receded from her cheeks. There was anger in her eyes, but Martha knew it wasn't anger at him. With her eyes sparkling like that, she looked a lot like Martha, he thought. He smiled at her and said, otherwise. She started out of her chair, and for an instant he thought she was going to come over and slap him. And she sank back wearily. If you were a man, you'd be thinking of some way to... They can be killed, you said. Her voice was bitter. The Zan? Oh, certainly. I've been studying them. They look horribly different from us, but I think that they have about the same metabolism we have, the same type of circulatory system, and probably the same type of digestive system. I think that anything that would kill one of us would kill one of them. But you said, oh, there are differences, of course. Whatever factor it is in man that ages him, well, they don't have. Or else they have some gland that man doesn't have. Something that renews cells. She had forgotten her anger now. She leaned forward eagerly. She said, I think that's right. And I don't think they feel pain. I was hoping that. But what makes you think so, my dear? I stretched a piece of wire that I found in the desk of my cubicle across my door so my Zan would fall over it. He did, and the wire cut his leg. Did he bleed red? Yes, but it didn't seem to annoy him. He didn't get mad about it, didn't even mention it. When he came back the next time, a few hours later, the cut was gone. Well, almost gone. I could see just enough of a trace of it to be sure it was the same Zan. Walter Phelan nodded slowly. He wouldn't get angry, of course, he said. They're emotionless. Maybe, if we killed one, they wouldn't even punish us. But it wouldn't do any good. They'd just give us our food through a trap door and treat us as men would have treated a zoo animal that had killed a keeper. They'd just see that he didn't have a crack at any more keepers. How many of them are there? She asked. About 200, I think, in this particular spaceship, but undoubtedly there are more where they came from. I have a hunch this is just an advance guard sent to clear off this planet and make it safe for Zan occupancy.
They did a good There was a knock at the door, and Walter Phelan called out.
Come in.
Azan stood in the doorway.
Hello, George, said Walter.
Hello, Walter, said the Zan.
It may or may not have been the same Zan, but it was always the same ritual.
What's on your mind? Walter asked.
An other creature sleeps and will not wake. A small furry one called a weasel.
Walter shrugged.
Well, it happens, George. Old man Death, I told you about him.
And worse, Azan has died this morning.
Is that worse? Walter looked at him blandly. Well, George, you have to get used to it if you're going to stay around here.
The Zan said nothing. It stood there. Finally, Walter said, Well?
About Weasel, you advise same?
Walter shrugged again. Probably wouldn't do any good, but sure, why not? The Zan left. Walter could hear his footsteps dying away outside. He grinned.
It might work, Martha, he said.
My name is Grace, Mr. Phelan. What might work?
My name is Walter, Grace. You may as well get used to it.
You know, Grace, you do remind me a lot of Martha. She was my wife as she died a couple of years ago.
I'm sorry, said Grace. But what might work? What were you talking about to the Zan?
Well, we'll know tomorrow, Walter said, and she couldn't get another word out of him.
That was the fourth day of the stay of the Zan. The next was the last.
It was nearly noon when one of the Zan came. After the ritual, he stood in the door, looking more alien than ever. It would be interesting to describe him for you, but there aren't words.
He said, We go. Our council met and decided.
Another of you died?
Last night. This is Planet of Death.
Walter nodded. You did your share. You're leaving 213 creatures alive out of quite a few billion. Don't hurry back.
Is there anything we can do?
Yes. You can hurry. And you can leave our door unlocked, but not the others. We'll take care of the others. Something clicked on the door. The Zan left.
Grace Evans was standing, her eyes shining. She asked, What? How?
Wait, cautioned Walter. Let's hear them blast off. It's a sound I want to remember. The sound came within minutes, and Walter Phelan, realizing how rigidly he'd been holding himself, relaxed in his chair.
There was a snake in the Garden of Eden, too, Grace, and it got us in trouble, he said musingly. But this one made up for it. I mean, the mate of the snake that died day before yesterday. It was a rattlesnake.
You mean it killed the two Zans who died?
But Walter nodded. They were babes in the woods here. When they took me to look at the first creature who was asleep and wouldn't wake up, and I saw that one of them was a rattler, I had an idea. Maybe, just maybe, Grace, I thought poison creatures were a development peculiar to Earth, and the Zan wouldn't know about them. And two, maybe their metabolism was enough like ours so that the poison would kill them. Anyway, I had nothing to lose trying, and both maybes turned out to be right.
How did you get the snakes to bite?
Walter Phelan grinned. He said, I told them what affection was. They didn't know. They were interested, I found, in preserving the remaining one of each species as long as possible to study the picture and record it before it died. I told them it would die immediately because of the loss of its mate, unless it had affection and petting, constantly. I show them how to with the duck. Luckily, it was a tame one, and I held it against my chest and petted it a while to show them. Then I let them take over with it. And the rattlesnake. He stood up and stretched, and then sat down again, more comfortably.
Well,
"We've got a world to plan," he said. "We'll have to let the animals out of the ark, and that will take some thinking and deciding. The herbivorous wild ones we can let go, you know, right away. The domestic ones, well, we'll do better to keep and take charge of. We'll need them. But the carnivora, you know, we'll have to decide. But I'm afraid it's got to be thumbs down." He looked at her. "And the human race, well, we've got to make a decision about that. A pretty important one." Her face was getting a little pink again, as it had yesterday. She sat rigidly in her chair. "No," she said. He didn't seem to have heard her. "Well, it's been a nice race, even if nobody won it," he said. "It'll be starting over again now, and it may go backwards a while, until it gets its breath. But we can gather books for it and keep most of its knowledge intact, the important things anyway. We can—" He broke off as she got up and started for the door, just the way his Martha would have acted, he thought, back in the days when he was courting her before they were married. He said, "Think it over, my dear, and take your time. But come back." The door slammed. He sat waiting, thinking out all the things there were to do. Once he started, but was no hurry to start them, and after a while, he heard her hesitant footsteps coming back. He smiled a little. "See? It wasn't horrible, really." The last man on Earth sat alone in a room. There was a knock at the door. Okay, the next one I took off the web as well from MysteryNet.com, and it's written by Bill Pronzini, and it's called "Here Comes Santa Claus." Carrie sprang her little surprise on me about the week before Christmas, and the worst thing about it was I was no longer fat. The 40-pound bowlful of jelly that had once hung over my belt was long gone. "Well, that doesn't matter," she said. "You can wear a pillow." "Why, me," I said. "They made me entertainment chairperson, for one thing, and for another, you're the biggest and jolliest man I know." "Ho, ho, ho," I said sourly. "It's for a good cause. Lots of good causes. Needy children, the homeless, three other charities. Where's your Christmas spirit?"
"I don't have any."
"Why don't you ask Eberhard?"
"Are you serious? Eberhard?"
"Somebody else, then. Anybody else?"
"You,"
she said. "Uh-uh. No. I love you madly, and I'll do just about anything for you, but not this. This is where I draw the line."
"Oh, come on. Quit acting like a Scrooge."
"I am a Scrooge. Bah! Humbug!"
"You like little kids. You know you do."
"I don't like kids. Where did you get that idea?"
"I've seen you with kids. That's where."
"An act. Just an act."
"So put it on again for the benefit. 5 o'clock until 9, 4 hours out of your life to help the less fortunate? Is that too much to ask?"
"In this case, yes." She looked at me, didn't say anything, just looked at me.
"No," I said. "There is no way I'm going to wear a Santa Claus suit and dangle little kiddies on my knee. You hear me? Absolutely no way."
"Ho, ho, ho," I said. The little girl perched on my knee looked up at me out of big round eyes. It was the same sort of big round eyes stare Carrie had given me the previous week.
"Are you really Santa Claus?"
she asked. "Well, yes, indeedy, and who would you be?"
"Melissa."
"What a pretty name. How old are you, Melissa?"
6 and a half.
"Oh, 6 and a half. Well, well. Tell old Santa what it is that you want for Christmas."
A dolly. Oh, what sort of a dolly? A big one?
Just a big one, no special kind?
Yes, a dolly that when you put water in her mouth and she wee-wees on herself.
I sighed. Ho, 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 I said.
The Gala Family Christmas Charity Benefit was being held in the Lowell High School Gymnasium out near Golden Gate Park. Half a dozen San Francisco businesses were sponsoring it, including Bates & Carpenter, the ad agency where Carrie works as a senior copywriter. So it was a pretty elaborate affair. The decoration committee had dressed the gym up to look like a cross between Santa's Village and the Dickens Christmas Fair. There was a huge, gaudy tree, lots of red and green bunting, and seasonal decorations, big clusters of holly and mistletoe, even fake snow. And the staff members were costumed as elves and other creatures imaginary and real. Carols and traditional favorites poured out of the loudspeakers. Booths positioned along the walls dispensed food, meat pies, plum pudding, gingerbread, and other sweets, and a variety of handmade toys and crafts, all donated. For the adults, there were a couple of city-sanctioned games of chance and a bar supplying wassail and other Christmassy drinks. For the kiddies, there was me. I sat on a throne-like chair on a raised dais at one end, encased in false whiskers and a wig, a paunch, red suit and cap, black boots and belt. All around me were cotton snowdrifts, a toy bag overflowing with gaily wrapped packages, a shiny papier-mâché version of Santa's sleigh with some cardboard reindeer. A couple of young women dressed as elves were there, too, to act as my helpers. Their smiles were as phony as my whiskers and paunch. They were only slightly less miserable than I was. For snaking out to one side and halfway across the packed enclosure was a line of little children the Pied Piper of Hamelin would have envied. Some with their parents, most without, and all eager to clamber onto old St. Nick's lap and share with him their innermost desires. Inside the Santa suit, I was sweating, and not just because it was warm in there. I imagined that every adult eye was on me, that snickers were lurking in every adult throat. This was ridiculous, of course, the more so because none of the 200 or so adults in attendance knew Santa's true identity. I had made Carrie swear an oath that she wouldn't tell anybody, especially not my partner Eberhardt, who would never let me hear the end of it if he knew. No more than half a dozen of those present knew me anyway, this being a somewhat ritzy crowd, and of those who did know me, three were members of the private security staff. Still, I felt exposed and vulnerable and acutely uncomfortable. I felt the way you would if you suddenly found yourself naked on a crowded city street, and I kept thinking, what if one of the newspaper photographers recognizes me and decides to take my picture? Oh, no. What if Eberhardt finds out? Or Barney Rivera or Joe DeFalco or one of my other so-called friends? Another kid was on his way toward my lap. I smiled automatically and sneaked a look at my watch. Oh, my goodness. It seemed as though I'd been there at least 2 hours, but it was only 45 minutes. That has passed since the opening ceremonies. More than 3 hours left to go. Close to 200 minutes. Nearly 12,000 seconds. The new kid climbed onto my knee. While he was doing that, one of those near the front of the line, overcome at the prospect of his own imminent audience with the nabob of the North Pole, began to make a series of all too familiar sounds. Another kid said, "Ah, gross, he's gonna throw up." Fortunately, however, the sick one's mother was with him. She managed to get him out of there in time to the strains of walking in a winter wonderland. I thought, what if he'd been sitting on my lap instead of standing in line? I thought, Carrie? I'll get you for this, Carrie. I listened to the new kid's demands and thought all about the other little hopeful piping voices I would have to listen to and sweated and smiled and tried not to squirm. If I squirm, people would start to snicker, the kids as well as the adults. They'd think Santa had to go potty and was trying not to wee-wee on himself.
This one had cider-colored hair. He said,
"You're not Santa Claus."
"Well, sure I am. Don't I look like Santa?"
"No, your face isn't red and you don't have a nose like a cherry."
"What's your name, Sonny?"
"Ronnie, you're not fat either."
"Sure, I'm fat. Ho, ho, ho."
"No, you're not."
"What do you want for Christmas, Ronnie?"
"I won't tell you. You're a fake. I don't need you to give me toys. I can buy my own toys."
"Oh, good for you."
"I don't believe in Santa Claus anyway," he said.
He was about 9, and in addition to being belligerent, he had mean little eyes. He was probably going to grow up to be an axe murderer. Well, either that or a politician. "If you don't want to talk to Santa," I said, feigning patience, "well, then how about getting off Santa's lap and letting one of the other boys and girls come up?"
"No."
Without warning, he punched me in the stomach, hard.
"Ha," he said, "a pillow. I knew your gut was just a pillow."
"Get off Santa's lap, Ronnie." While I was listening to an 8-year-old with braces and a homicidal gleam in his eye tell me he wanted a tank that has this neat missile in it and you shoot the missile and it blows everything up when it lands, Carrie appeared with a cup in her hand. She motioned for me to join her at the far side of the dais. Behind Santa's sleigh, I got rid of the budding warmonger, told the nearest elf I was taking a short break, stood up creakily and with as much dignity as I could muster, and made my way through the cotton snowdrifts to where Carrie stood. She looked far better in her costume than I did in mine. In fact, she looked so innocent and fetching, I forgot for the moment that I was angry with her. She was dressed as an angel, all in white, with a coat hanger halo wrapped in tinfoil. If real angels look like her, well, I couldn't wait to get to heaven. She handed me a cup. It was full of some sort of punchy-looking, funny-looking, shiny brown thing that floated on top. "I thought you could use a little Christmas cheer," she said. "I could use a lot of Christmas cheer. Is this stuff spiked?"
"Well, of course not. Since when do you drink hard liquor?"
"Since I sat down on that throne over there."
"Oh, now, it can't be that bad."
"No, well, let's see. A 5-year-old screamed so loud in my left ear that I'm still partially deaf. A fat kid stepped on my foot and nearly broke a toe. And another kid actually kneed me in the crotch and nearly broke something else. Not 3 minutes ago, a mugger in training named Ronnie punched me in the stomach and called me a jerk. And those are just the lowlights."
"Oh, poor baby."
That didn't sound very sincere. "Well, the fact is," she said, "most of the kids love you. I overheard a couple of them telling their parents what a nice old Santa you are." "Yeah." I tried some of the punch. It wasn't too bad, considering the suspicious brown thing floating in it. Must have been a deformed clove, I decided. The only other alternative, something coming out of the back end of a mouse, was unthinkable. How much more of this does nice old Santa have to endure? 2.5 hours. Oh, man, I'll never make it.
"Don't be such a curmudgeon," she said. "It's 2 days before Christmas. We're taking in lots of money for the needy, and everybody's having a grand time except you.
Well, and Mrs. Simmons." "Who's Mrs. Simmons?"
"Randolph Simmons' wife, you know, the corporate attorney. She lost her wallet somehow, all her credit cards and $200 in cash."
"Well, that's too bad. Tell her I'll replace the $200 if she agrees to trade places with me right now."
Carrie gave me one of her "sometimes you're exasperating" looks.
"Just hang in there, Santa," she said, and started away. "Don't use that phrase around the kid named Ronnie," I called after her. "It's liable to give him ideas." I had been back on the throne less than 10 seconds when who should have reappeared but the little thug himself. Ronnie, he wasn't alone this time. He had a bushy-mustached, gray-suited, scowling man with him. The two of them clumped up onto the dais, shouldered past an elf with a cherubic little girl in hand, and confronted me. The mustached guy said in a low, angry voice, "What the heck's the idea threatening my kid?" Oh, fine and dandy. This was all I needed, an irate father.
"Answer me, pal. What's the idea telling Ronnie you'd shove a pillow down his throat?"
He punched me in the stomach, I said. So, that don't give you the right to threaten him. I ought to punch you in the stomach.
Do it, Dad, Ronnie said. Punch the old fake.
Nearby, the cherub started to cry, loudly. We all looked at her. Ronnie's dad said, What'd you do, threaten her too?
Wanna see Santa? It's my turn, it's my turn.
The elf said, Don't worry, honey, you'll get your turn. Ronnie's dad said, Apologize to any kid and we'll let it go. Ronnie said,
Nah, sock him one.
I said, Mind telling me your name? It was Ronnie's dad I spoke to. He looked blank for 2 or 3 seconds, after which he said, Huh? What's your name? What is it?
What do you want to know for?
You look familiar. Very familiar. In fact, I think maybe we've met before. He stiffened. Then he took a long, wary look at me as if trying to see past my whiskers. Then he blinked, and all of a sudden his righteous indignation vanished and was replaced by a nervousness that bordered on the furtive. He wet his lips, backed off a step.
Come on, Dad, the little thug said. Punch his lights out.
His dad told him to shut up. To me, he said, let's forget about the whole thing, okay? And then he turned in a hurry and dragged a protesting Ronnie down off the dais and back into the crowd. I stared after them, and there was a little click in my mind, and I was seeing a photograph of Ronnie's dad as a younger man without the big bushy mustache and with a name and number across his chest. Oh, Ronnie's dad and I knew each other all right. I had once had a hand in having him arrested and sent to Sam Quentin on a grand larceny rap. Ronnie's dad was Marky Waters, a professional pickpocket and jack-of-all-thievery who, in his entire life, had never gone anywhere or done anything to benefit anyone except Marky Waters. So what was he doing at the Gala Family Christmas Charity Benefit? She lost her wallet somehow, all her credit cards and $200 in cash. Right. Practicing his trade, of course. I should have stayed on the dais. I should have sent one of the elves to notify security while I perched on the throne and continued to act as a listening post for the kiddies. But I didn't. Like a fool, I decided to handle the matter myself. Like a fool, I went charging off into the throng of the cherubs, cries of "Wanna see Santa?" and "My turn to see Santa" rising to a crescendo behind me. The milling crush of celebrants had closed around Marky Waters and his son, and I could no longer see them. But they had been heading at an angle toward the far assisted entrance, so that was the direction I took. The rubber boots I wore were a size too small and pinched my feet, forcing me to walk in kind of a mincing step, and as if that wasn't bad enough, the boots were new and made squeaking sounds like a pair of rusty hinges. I also had to do some jostling to get through and around little knots of people, and some of the looks my maneuvers elicited were not of the peace on earth, goodwill to men variety. One elegantly dressed guy said, "Watch the hands, Claus," which might have been funny if I were not in such a dark and stormy frame of mind. I was almost to the line of food booths along the east wall when I spotted Waters again, stopped near the second to the last booth. One of his hands was clutching Ronnie's wrist, the other plucking at an obese woman in a red and green diagonally striped dress that made her look like a gigantic candy cane. Marky had evidently collided with her in his haste and caused her to spill a cup of punch on herself. She was loudly berating him for being a clumsy oaf and refusing to let go of a big handful of his jacket until she'd had her say. I minced and squeaked through another cluster of adults, all of whom were singing in accompaniment to the song now playing over the loudspeakers. The song of all things was, "Here Comes Santa Claus." Waters may not have heard the song, but its message got through to him just the same. He saw me bearing down on him from 30 feet away and understood immediately what my intentions were.
His expression turned panicky. He tried to tear loose from the obese woman's grip. She hung on with all the tenacity of a bulldog. I was 10 feet from getting my bulldog hands on him when he proceeded to transform the Gaelic Family Christmas Charity benefit from fun and frolic into chaos. He let go of Ronnie's wrist, shouted, "Run, kid!" And then with his free hand, he sucker-punched the obese woman on the uppermost of her chins. She not only released his jacket and backpedaled into a lurching swoon that upset 3 other merrymakers and sent all 4 of them to the floor in a wild tangle of arms and legs. Voices rose in sudden alarm. Somebody screamed like a fire siren going off. Bodies scattered out of the way, and Marky Waters went racing toward freedom. I gave chase, dodging and juking and squeaking. I wouldn't have caught him except that while he was looking back over his shoulder to see how close I was, he tripped over something, his own feet maybe, and down he went in a sprawl. I reached him just as he scrambled up again. I laid both hands on him and growled, "This is as far as you go, Waters." Whereupon he kicked me in the shin and yanked free. I yelled. He staggered off. I limped after him. Shouts and shrieks echoed through the gym. So did the thunder of running feet and thudding bodies as more of the party animals stampeded. A woman came rushing out from inside the farthest of the food booths, got in Marky's path, and caused him to veer sideways to keep from plowing into her. That in turn allowed me to catch up to him in front of the booth. I clapped a hand on his shoulder, this time spun him around, and he smacked me in the chops with something warm and soggy that had been sitting on the booth serving counter. A meat pie. He hit me in the face with a pie. That was the last indignity in a night of indignities. Playing Santa was bad enough. Playing Lou Costello to a thief's Bud Abbott was intolerable. I roared. I pawed at my eyes and scraped off beef gravy and false whiskers and white wig. I lunged and caught Waters again before he could escape. I wrapped my arms around him. It was my intention to twist him around and get him into a crippling hammerlock, but he was stronger than he looked. So instead, we performed a kind of a crazy, lurching bear hug dance for a few seconds. That came to an end, predictably, when we banged into one of the booth supports and the whole front framework collapsed in a welter of wood and bunting and pie and paper plates and plastic utensils with us in the middle of it all. Marky squirmed out from underneath me feebly and tried to crawl away through the wreckage. I disentangled myself from some of the bunting, lunged at his legs, hung on when he tried to kick loose, and then crawled on top of him, flipped him over on his back, fended off a couple of ineffectual blows and did some effectual things to his head until he stopped struggling and decided to become unconscious. I sat astraddle him, panting and puffing and wiping gravy out of my eyes and nose. The tumult, I realized then, had subsided somewhat behind me. I could hear the loudspeakers again. The song playing now was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and I could hear voices lifted tentatively nearby. Just before a news photographer came hurrying up and snapped a picture of me and my catch, just before a horrified Carrie and a couple of tardy security guards arrived, I heard 2 voices in particular speaking in odd tones. "My goodness," one of them said, "what happened?"
"I don't know," the other one said, "but it sure looks like Santa Claus went berserk."
There were 3 of us in the football coach's office near the rear of the gym, Marky Waters and me and one of the security guards. It was 15 minutes later, and we were waiting for the arrival of San Francisco's finest. Waters was dejected and resigned. The guard was pretending not to be amused, and I was in a foul humor, thanks to a combination of acute embarrassment, some bruises and contusions, and the fact that I had no choice but to keep on wearing the gravy-stained remnants of the Santa Claus suit. It was what I'd come here in. My own clothes were in Carrie's apartment. On the desk between Waters and me was a diamond and sapphire brooch, a fancy platinum cigarette case, and a gold money clip containing 3 crisp $50 bills. We had found all these items nestled companionably inside Marky's jacket pocket. I prodded the brooch with a finger, which prompted the guard to say, nice haul. The brooch alone must be worth a couple of grand. I didn't say anything. Neither did Marky. The owner of the gold clip and 350s had reported them missing to security just before Waters and I staged our minor riot. The owner of the brooch and cigarette case didn't make themselves known yet, which was something of a tribute to Marky's light-fingered talents, talents that would soon land him back in the slammer on another grand larceny rap. He had his chin resting on his chest. Now he raised his head and looked at me. "My kid," he said, as if he just remembered he had one. "He get away?" "No." One of the other guards nabbed him out front. "Just as well. Where is he?" "Being held close by. He's okay." Marky let out a heavy breath. "I shouldn't have brought him along," he said. "So why did you?" "It's Christmas, and the paper said this shindig was for kids, too. Ronnie and me don't get together too much since his mother ran out on us a couple of years ago." "Get out together." "Uh-huh," I said. "And besides, you figured it would be easier to make your scores if you had a kid along as camouflage?" He shrugged. "You, though, I sure didn't figure on somebody like you being here. What the heck's a private dick doing dressed up in a Santa Claus suit?" "I've been asking myself that same question all night." "I mean, how can you figure a thing like that?" Marky said. "Ronnie comes running up. He says it's not really Santa up there, and the guys pretending to be Santa threatened him. Said he'd shove a pillow down the kid's throat. What am I supposed to do?" "I'd done a good night's work. I wanted to get out of while the getting was good, but I couldn't let some jerk get away with threatening my kid. Could I? I mean, I'm a father too, right?" He let out another heavy breath. "I wish I wasn't a father," he said. I said, "What about the wallet, Marky?" "Huh?" "The wallet and the 200 in cash that's in it." "Huh?" "This stuff here isn't all you swipe tonight. You also got a wallet belonging to Mrs. Randolph Simmons. It wasn't on you, and neither was the 200. What'd you do with them?" "I never scored a wallet," he said. "Not tonight." "Marky, I swear it. The other stuff, sure, you got me on that, but I'm telling you, I didn't score a wallet tonight." I scowled at him, but his denial had the ring of truth. He had no reason to lie about the wallet. Well, then, had Mrs. Simmons lost it after all? If that was the case, then I'd gone chasing after Waters for no good reason except that he was a convicted felon. I felt the embarrassment warming my face again. What if he hadn't clipped anybody tonight? I'd have looked like an even bigger fool than I did right now. Something tickled my memory and set me to pursuing a different and more productive line of thought. Oh, of course. I'd been right in the first place. Mrs. Randolph Simmons' wallets had been stolen, not lost, and I knew now who had done the stealing. But the knowledge didn't make me feel any better. In fact, it made me feel worse. "Empty your pockets."
"What for?"
"Because I told you to, that's what for.
I don't have to do what you tell me."
"If you don't, I'll empty them for you."
"I want a lawyer,"
he said. "You're too young to need a lawyer. Now empty your pockets before I smack you one." Ronnie glared at me. I glared back.
"If you smack me," he said, "it's police brutality. 9 years going on 40.
"I'm not the police, remember? This is your last chance, kid. Empty the pockets or else." He said, but he emptied the pockets. He didn't have Mrs. Randolph Simmons' wallet, but he did have her $200. $204, to be exact. "I don't need you to give me toys. I can buy my own toys." "Sure. $204 can buy a lot of toys, not to mention a lot of grief." "What'd you do with the wallet, Ronnie?"
"What wallet?"
"Dumped it in somewhere nearby, right?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"No? Then where'd you get the money?"
"I found it."
"Uh-huh. In Mrs. Randolph Simmons' purse."
"Who's she?"
"Your old man put you up to it, or was this your own idea?"
He favored me with a cocky little grin. "I'm smart," he said. "I'm going to be just like my dad when I grow up."
"Yeah," I said sadly. "A chip off the old block, if there ever was one." Midnight. Carrie and I were sitting on the couch in her living room. I sat with my head tipped back and my eyes closed. I had a thundering headache and a brain clogged with gloom. It had been a long, long night, full of all sorts of humiliations and the sight of a 9-year-old kid, even a thuggish 9-year-old kid, being carted off to youth authority at the same time his father was being carted off to the Hall of Justice was a pretty unfestive one. I hadn't seen the last of the humiliations either. Tonight's fiasco would get plenty of tongue-in-cheek treatment in the morning papers, complete with photographs. Half a dozen reporters and photographers had arrived at the gym in tandem with the police, and so there was no way Eberhardt and my other friends could help but find out. I was in for weeks of sly and merciless ribbing. Carrie must have intuited my headache because she moved over close beside me and began to massage my temples. She's good at massage. Some of the pain began to ease almost immediately. None of the gloom, though. You can't massage away gloom. After a while, she said,
I guess you blame me.
Why would I blame you?
Well, if I hadn't talked you into playing Santa...
No, you didn't talk me into anything. I did it because I wanted to help you and the benefit. No, I blame myself for what happened. I should have handled Marky Waters better. If I had, the benefit wouldn't have come to such a bad end, and you'd have made a lot more money for the charities.
Well, we made quite a bit as it is, Carrie said, and you caught a professional thief and saved 4 good citizens from losing valuable property.
And put a kid in the youth authority for Christmas?
Well, you're not responsible for that. His father is.
Sure, I know, but it doesn't make me feel any better. She was silent for a time, at the end of which she leaned down and kissed me, warmly. I opened my eyes. Well, what was that for?
For being who you and what you are. You grump and you grumble and you act a curmudgeon, but that's a facade. Beneath, you're a nice, caring man with a big heart.
Yeah, me and St. Nick.
Exactly. She looked at her watch. It is now officially the 24th, Christmas Eve. How would you like one of your presents a little early?
Well, depends on which one.
Oh, I think you'll like it. She stood up. I'll go get it ready for you. Give me 5 minutes.
Christmas in jail. Christmas in jail. I had a little too much.
Well, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour. Keith Tyler saying thanks for joining me and tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long. Feeling